Welcome back to the program. I think we know that disasters are happening around the world with greater and greater frequency. But how do most of us respond to those disasters? How do we respond to 9/11, to Katrina, to the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, the earthquake in Haiti, or the earthquake and tsunami in Sri Lanka in 2004? For many of us, we may have written a check, or even easier, just sent a text to make us feel better. For one woman and a group of her friends, they decided they needed to do something more. That they would do something that would not only change their lives, but profoundly change the lives of the people they would help. We're going to talk about this story with my guest, Allison Thompson. She's a filmmaker and humanitarian volunteer. In 2010, she received the Order of Australia for her volunteer work and her contribution to humankind. Her documentary film, The Third Wave, about her experiences volunteering in Sri Lanka, premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival and was screened to the presidential jury at the 2008 Cannes Film Festival. It is my pleasure to welcome Allison Thompson to this program to talk about her book, The Third Wave, A Volunteer Story. Allison, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
When did you realize that you were going to become a volunteer, that this was going to be, to a certain extent, your life's work?
It all happened on September 11th when the planes hit the tower, and I had a lot of friends that worked down there in the tower, and I used to work on Wall Street a long time ago, and I just raced down there by myself on my rollerblades and ended up working down there in the first 6 days and collecting the bodies and just giving out water and a hug and cleaning the toilets. And I stayed down there for 9 months, and I realized you don't have to belong to a government organization or big NGOs, big aid groups. I can do it myself. The disasters are getting so big. There is a spot for me to slip in and help out. So that's when I really learned how to volunteer and that there's room for me too.
And then 2004 came along and the earthquake and tsunami in southern Asia and in Sri Lanka. What happened?
Well, I thought it's Christmas holidays and I'm staring at CNN and I was just watching the images and they showed all the bodies and the trauma over there. And I just knew I had to go, and I had that experience September 11th. I thought, yeah, there's going to be room for me over there. So I grabbed my boyfriend at the time and raced over there, and I met two other people at the airport. So there were four of us, and we started just driving down to the disaster. It was 10 days after the disaster, and there's no one helping. And I'm like, wow. And there were aid groups 100 miles way down the coast in either direction, but there was like so many people there with no food and water and help and in desperate situations. So we just started helping them beside the road, giving us a bit of water and doing a bit of medical. And my friend was doing some magic tricks for the kids to laugh. And it just became so big that we couldn't leave. There was no one helping them. And we just kept staying week upon week upon week, and then it was 14 months later. So we just stayed.
Your original plan was to go down there for 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, it just couldn't leave. It wouldn't have been for humanity. I just couldn't have left. These people were so desperate. They looked at us. We had 3,000 people every day looking to us for help, and they were in shock. They had 20 members of their family dead. They just needed our help, so we just couldn't leave.
We hear so much about the NGOs, about all the money that gets contributed to these causes. What happened? Where are all these organizations? Where's all the help?
Yeah, I get tired of this, where's the money, because I really researched it for 14 months and went to the head of the UN, went to Harvard, to all these smart people, and they're like, Allison, so much money is raised that they don't know where it all goes. A lot of it is pledged but doesn't get there. A lot of it is innocently sitting in bank accounts around the world, and they actually don't know where to send it to or who to send it to, and it gets interest upon interest. There's a lot of corruption in third worlds. Also, with a lot of the big NGOs, you know, you make a donation, you're paying for their high-rise buildings, their faxes, their expenses, their flights, their expensive hotels. You know, I've seen it happen with my own eyes, and that there are a lot of amazing aid groups doing amazing work, and sometimes they're just caught up also in bureaucracy and red tape. So it's not them themselves, but it's the organization within itself. There needs to be more power on the ground going down the level to be able to get things done. So we try to show how we can do it even without the money. People say, can I send you money? I said, look, send me your time, a donation of time. You're here on this planet for 60 years. Maybe give you 1 week out of your life, and it could be the best week in your entire life.
Is there a conflict? Has there been a conflict between you and some of your friends and these other groups and organizations that come in on a larger scale and have their own ideas about how things should be done?
not so much a conflict, because we just want to work with everyone. And right now in Haiti, we have about 12 small grassroots groups all really working together. The big ones, they don't want to work with anyone. They want to come in and have their section, and they don't want to work. So that's the main problem. I'm working in Haiti, and in the early days, I was working with Sean Penn running his camp, and he got everybody to work together, like from USAID, Red Cross, everybody. And he says, look, we're going to move these people out of this danger zone. If you don't want to work, F off and go somewhere else, but I need you all to work together. And I haven't seen that in 10 years, and it was absolutely fabulous. So we just got to all work together, because that's how we get stuff done, and we're stronger together than we are alone.
Talk about what you have found in these places, in Haiti and in Sri Lanka, in terms of the population, in terms of the people and their needs.
Well, in Haiti, I think it's the worst thing I've ever seen, and I've been all through Africa and India, and it's just so overpopulated. There isn't enough food and water. And every day there, I'm like, that's the worst thing I've ever seen. And then the next day, I see orphans, like 60 of them, just living in the dirt, and the oldest is maybe 8 or 9 looking after them. And they've got maggots and worms crawling out of them. I'm like, no, that's the worst thing I've ever seen. And then that night in my tent, I'll be lying down in the dark, and way off in the distance, I hear the women being raped for half an hour, and these men screaming and laughing. And just every day, it's just something new, and I don't understand. It's an hour and a half from American soil, and it's just in a desperate situation. And it's, you know, I got a letter from someone today who's working alongside me, and they said the women are stockpiling bleach because they just can't take it anymore. The conditions are so bad. And I said, well, bleach, what was it, for the cholera and that? They're like, no, they're planning on mass suicides. Like, you know, I was crying all morning about it, you know. And I feel very me going on about my book by my book, but the book is really to inspire volunteering. But in the meantime, I should be back there helping. There's just so much work to be done there.
What keeps you going? What prevents you from getting so depressed about the sheer scope and hopelessness of it all?
You know, in the early days I was in Haiti, I was like, there's always hope. But for the first time in my life, I said to myself, she's not here right now. She's just not here. I felt really hope the last few months. You can get so caught up in the bigger picture, and I can't help the whole country, and you can get depressed about just the too much of the bigger problems. You have to bring it down as, I can help this person. And that's a big thing, if you can just save one life or help one. And usually when you're trying to help one, it's more than that. It's like 10 or 20, or it grows. So if you keep that in mind, and I can help one person, well, then you don't get depressed. Plus, you know, when you're there, it's just, people just love you. You're surrounded by hundreds of kids, and they outpour their love, and you even forget about all your own problems. There's no time to even think about our small little things that are going on, because their problems are so much bigger. So there's so much rewarding stuff that goes on too, and there's so much unconditional love and really wonderful stuff that you receive in return as well.
Is it all about the short-term solutions to problems, or is there an opportunity to think about what happens after, to think more long-term in terms of some of this?
Yeah, I go in at the initial stage for the rescue, but I stay. And, you know, most of the aid groups pull out after 6 months, but I try to think of long-term solutions. And in Haiti, it's all about sustainability. We can't just, Haiti's a country of NGOs that hand out water and food, and you can't just keep doing that for 50 years. You need to teach them jobs and train them, and businesses need to come in, the economy, you know, build hotels and have people working in them. And that's what we've been doing with our women. We have an organization that dance with gender based, that we deal with their physical, mental needs, but then we train them in jewelry making or hat making, whatever, so we can sort of move them forward into a future, and that's what we've been working on.
And this has been effective in Sri Lanka in particular, where you started or were involved in helping start many businesses there.
Yeah, we started, you know, in the end, hundreds of businesses, and when I say started the business, it might be just $100 for a family to sell dried fish, but that's their job for their future, and it really does work, and that's what we're working on.
You mentioned Haiti being the worst example you've seen. Talk a little bit about when you first got there, what that was like.
Oh, we landed. I was there with Sean Penn because he texted me about going. He says, "Hey, ?" I'm like, "Yeah, let's do it." Because he'd had that great experience in Katrina. We just went down as a volunteer, and he'd rescued about 40, 50 people. So he knew my work in Sri Lanka. So he's like, "Let's go." And I found like 10 doctors on Facebook. We all coordinated, and then we ended up landing. He got permission from the U.S. government to land where the military were all working out of, and the 82nd Airborne picked us up, and we just ended up going off into the jungle. And a few days later, we found this camp of 65,000 people that really needed help, and the 82nd Airborne were there, so we joined together forces. And so daily, we just drive through the streets on Hummers, and they drop us off, and we march through the streets rescuing people, and legs were hanging off. You know, there were so many amputations after the quake. But anyway, we just worked. Those first few works were very desperate and just saving lives. Sean was running around, you know, he wouldn't sleep for days, working 20-hour days, running around buying x-ray machines and rescuing children and taking them off to cars to field hospitals and, you know, things like that.
Talk about your own training. I mean, you had some medic training, but really you've learned a lot from all of this.
Yeah, I was a basic nurse's aide and field medic, but over the years I've just learned so much from watching other doctors and nurses and just really being out there. You know, you're out there by yourself and someone's had their finger cut off and you just, I've just learned how, you know, to wrap them up and really care for them in that first initial stage. It's real civil war medicine, but you know, it's the difference of saving their life. So you learn so much out in the field. Like, I have doctors and nurses come down, or EMTs, and they see things down there they would never see, you know, working for 20 years in a hospital or in America, you know, from tuberculosis to cholera to all sorts of things. And even all the volunteers who have no skills to medical, they end up, if they can do little things to save lives. And I've heard that they go back home and they actually start little first aid courses or EMT courses so they can get better, because one day it's the big one's going to hit America. And, you know, I have a tsunami center in Sri Lanka, and I study the earthquakes every day, and I'm really concerned about the big one along the California coast.
You mentioned that you're out there alone. There really is nobody that you're responsible to. You're just out there with your people. Talk a little bit about that experience, that part of the experience.
I really enjoy being an independent volunteer because you can get out there. Okay, these people need a toilet. We need to stop a spread of cholera. Okay, Donnie, one of my friends, go out there and build a toilet tomorrow. He does. When you're with a bigger organization, there's so much bureaucracy and red tape. You have to send that email back, and you have to get permission. It goes around to 20 people, and then maybe 4 months later you get that permission to build the toilet. I don't have enough time to deal with that, so I need to get in there, get my head down, and get work done very fast, and it actually really does work. So that's just the way I work, and it's just a much faster way to go.
What about the economics of it? Where does the money come from to sustain you and your friends and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, I say to people I'm a billionaire inside, but I've never had more than $100 in my bank account. In Sri Lanka, it was very hard. It was all family and friends. You know, we left home with a few $100. But when we came time to rebuilding the 510 homes in the village, family, friends, spreading the word, we rebuilt those before any large organization had built one home. So it's not really about that. It's this heart that comes out and push and spreads the word. But in Haiti, it was very different. We had Sean Penn, and he is very powerful to the world and has a lot of friends, and he has the press. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's how we get it out. So he raised large amounts of money, because this time, instead of 3,000 people, we were looking after 65,000 people. Needed to get water trucks in and sanitation and many, many big things. But this organization, this little one I'm in now, this three of us called We Advance, we have fundraisers and we go to many organizations and try to use the things that they have already. We go to them and say, "We don't need your money. Can you give us 20 hospital beds? Can you do this? And it seems like it's really working. So it's sort of cutting the money element out and working with all the other groups that already have goods. And sometimes in return we can give them mental health training or something else that we might have someone that can help. So there's many different ways of going about the money issue.
Over time, do the NGOs, the more established relief organizations, do they provide help? I mean, can they be still useful?
That's a very good question. I think in the end we're all needed, and there's pluses and negatives for both sides of the equation. I'm becoming more and more frustrated with the bigger ones because just really being there on the ground. You know, they have, for example, one we've been dealing with, which is the biggest one in the world. They've raised billions, and they keep putting these ads up. No, do you need help in gender-based violence? We can support your program. We've written to them 12 times now, and no response or something similar to that. So we're still trying. But as of October, they lose that money if they don't give out to all the different groups. And right now it's pushing along. We're going to still send another 12 letters to them. But if they don't use all that money, then they lose it. It goes somewhere else. So it's just very tricky question. I'd have to talk about it for a few hundred days to really give you a proper answer on that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the main thing I see is we all got to work together. And I know they have their accountability to their big donors and that, but there really needs to be some serious changes going on.
To the extent that there have been so many of these disasters, Haiti, Sri Lanka, Japan most recently, to what extent does that bifurcate all of the resources, including yourself, and the work that you're able to do?
It's tricky because the disasters are becoming more and more frequent. Like, we're on the ground, but then all the NGOs and everybody pick up and they race off to the next one. So it really leaves us really high and dry and stranded. It had been a tsunami when Katrina hit. Everybody raced over there, and I really wanted to do that too. You know, I wanted to be on American soil, but I had to follow through on what I was doing there. But it really affects it. But it leaves it open to the volunteers, to everyone out there else that doesn't belong to aid organizations. We need to pick up the slack because they are too big. They're really too big for all of us to take care of. So everybody else out there can really do their piece, even if it's just for a few hours on the phone or emailing or help coordinating things. What I've found now is with this big response, you know, even from Katrina and Haiti and everything, there is aid all over America sitting there in churches, down in the basement, in warehouses, in people's houses. Oh, I've got 4 boxes of this, 4 boxes of that. I'm starting a thing to coordinate all that, find that aid, and like what the government did with the taxes. Okay, we forgive you in the past for not sending it or whatever, but let's work now and let's find it all. I found $2.6 million worth of meds in Miami a week ago, and the group was so embarrassed. They said, yeah, we raised it after Haiti, but we just don't know how to get it there because people forget it costs money to put it on containers and ships.
Mm-hmm.
So we're about to start a U.S.-wide campaign about let's find this aid and let's use it and let's send it to where it really should be because it's really needed.
Has technology and social networking helped you in that effort?
Oh, yes. Mm. Oh, yes. I used to be so against Twitter, like people like, oh, I'm eating a hamburger, I'm walking down the street. Mm. I get the Haiti, and I started it, and it has saved so many lives. I had to get oxygen. The whole country was out of oxygen. Someone tweeted back, okay, it's at the Brazilian base, go over there. So I raced over, and I traded some whiskey for oxygen. Mm. Another case was a rabies case where someone was dying from being bitten by a dog. And I sent it out to the world and the Twitter world, and someone had it on a plane for 3 hours from the DR down to save the lady. And another last example is I was very sick in my tent, and there was a generator on, and nobody could hear me calling out for help. And I tweeted it out to the world, and someone in New York tweeted it back to the girl in the tent next to me, my friend, and she came in and she helped save me. Mm-hmm. So it's just so important. Really out there on the ground for all of us to get message out to each other on Twitter and Facebook, and also for news. By the time the news hits, CNN or something, it's days later, and we don't know that there's dangers or whatever's going on. So if we're in an area where there's a riot, we Twitter it out, and everybody else in Haiti and all the volunteers and then big aid groups, oh, we see that, okay, let's stay away from that area. So it's just become so important, and it's basically running the operation.
Can
Twitter and Facebook.
Can the media do more in terms of covering this? Would that help?
Oh, yes. It really would help. you know, after the tsunami, I get out of, just after 6 months after the tsunami, I came out for a break for a week, and, you know, I'm thinking it's going to be all over the media, and it's Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt breaking up, and they seem to have this formula. If we get there, we show it, we show the suffering, we talk to the few ladies that they lost the babies, we do this, and there's this formula for 3 or 4 months, and then they do the closing up story, and someone came in Sri Lanka, and they were trying to do a closing up story, I'm like, no, we need food, and we need water, and we need this. And they're like, no, sorry, the editor needs the wrapping up story. I'm sorry, I can't do that, you know. And the journalists are so important for that, for to keep it going. Like, that's why we go there. That's why volunteers see the story. Oh, yeah, they still need it. Oh, okay. Because everyone says to me, oh, we thought it was over because it wasn't in the news anymore. And so they play a, such an important part of actually saving thousands of lives, those photographers, those journalists, the four radio shows out of California.
How do you keep doing this without getting burnt out, Allison?
I'm actually a little tired now, but it was more from leaving Haiti to do the book tour. But how do I not burn out? I get so much out of it as well. Like, for example, in Haiti, I lost weight, I got a suntan, I fell in love. So, well, you get all these, you know, things out of it. Sometimes, like in Haiti, there's the most beautiful beaches. Wherever you go in these disasters, it seems to be like there's a really nice parts of the area too. So I might take a day or two off every now and then, and I'll go and I'll just lie in the water and just float, or something similar to that. You know, with fellow volunteers, we'll sit on the beach at night with a guitar and we might sing, or a bonfire. There's always way to relieve that. And I'm not saying you have to go and volunteer full time. Like, a lot of volunteers come for 2-3 weeks, and then they go back to their jobs and their lives, so they recoup and everything. And then maybe towards the end of the year, they might come back for another 2 weeks. So there's a lot of things to do like that. And a lot of the volunteers come home and they write me letters and they're like, I can't fit back into my own life. Oh, it's so different, the culture shock. And I'm like, that's a good thing, because the world's changed now because of you, and you'll keep on doing it. So that's a good thing you're changed inside.
Allison Thompson, her book is The Third Wave, A Volunteer Story. And you have a website also, Allison, if people want more information.
Yeah, thethirdwavebook.com.
Allison Thompson, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
No, thank you. Thank you.